Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi, the streaming online cinema. For your free 30-day trial to Mubi, go to mubi.com/filmstage. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian... Wow, my throat just gave up on me. I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan, and with me today to talk about our top 10 favorite films of the year 2016, we have Bill Graham. For anyone who missed the last episode, Bill's New Year's resolution was to be more pumped in the new year, and that is why we just got that weird ape call. We also have Michael Snyder.
Hello.
Hello.
I don't think we celebrated the 2016 officially being over yesterday.
We did not. We had a lot to talk about Silence. So yes, the year that killed and destroyed and maimed both people and dream alike is over. And
yeah, burn it to the ground.
Hopefully. You know what's funny, though, is like, if I think about all the things that happened to me personally, which of course is the best way to live one's life, is only thinking about yourself. 2016 was fucking fantastic.
Like, yeah, you had a child.
I got married. I had a child. I bought a house. Like, everything went well for me in 2016. So I apologize, because I guess there was just some cosmic reversal where God finally said, like, all right, Brian, you've been suffering for a while. Here, have a good year. However, as we also said in our Silence podcast, I would let 100 people suffer before I did anything. And I guess that's just what happened. what a terrible intro for this. What a horrifying way to begin this this whole endeavor.
Happy New Year!
Yay! For anyone who is curious, yes, we did record Silence. That review should be out at the same time as this, coming in quick succession. So check that out if you want to know our deep thoughts on Silence. Today we will be doing our top tens with assorted shenanigans, and that is it. That is all. So the sooner we get into that, the sooner we can get out of here. Let me remind everyone that we can be followed on Twitter, at Film Stage Show. You can find us on Facebook, search for The Film Stage Show. And, of course, you can email us your longer thoughts at podcast@thefilmstage.com. And, as always, we are brought to you by Mubi. Mubi is the streaming online cinema that, unlike the Netflixes and Hulus of the world, actually takes the time to make sure that their movies are good, that they are aesthetically interesting, that they are culturally relevant, that they are, in fact, worth your time. I went on Netflix the other day, and my wife and I decided that we didn't want to watch anything too crazy, so we watched something called Jeruzalem. It is a found footage zombie horror movie that takes place in Jerusalem. It is not great, and it is indicative of, I would say, 90% of the content on Netflix. Unlike that, however, Mubi only has 30 movies a day, so you never get lost in the choice paradox where you have so many options you can't make up your mind. Not only that, but every day they introduce a new stellar film for you to watch. So, for instance, we currently have The Fantastic Planet, which I love, which I can't talk enough about. We also have what appears to be an insane film from Takashi Miike, The Happiness of the Katakuris, and I mean, I just like those two alone are probably better than I would say 77% of what's on Netflix. So if you would like to have some very smart people pick a selection of films just for you, go to mubi.com/filmstage to start your 30-day trial of Mubi. And don't forget that Mubi now has an app on Roku, which makes watching Mubi even easier. So again, a free 30-day trial if you go to mubi.com/filmstage. Mubi. New year, no tagline. All right. Gentlemen, are we prepared? Are we ready?
Sure. Woo! Good thing we're over Skype, so we won't kill each other when we disagree.
Yeah. There was always... this is the first
time. Speak for yourself.
Bill, were you on the top 10 last year?
No, sir.
Okay, yeah. This is the first time the three of us have done a top 10 together. It's both of your first times doing the top 10 on the Film Stage show. It used to get a little heated. What was even funnier, though, was the fact that when it was Danny and Nick and I, we always had only one crossover. I don't know how that's possible. Mm-hmm. In a world where so many top 10 lists look so similar, Nick and Danny and I somehow managed to only ever have one crossover. It was insanity. So I'm curious to see how this will go. So we're going to start...
Wait, what was the crossover last year then?
It wasn't Nick and Danny last year. It was Amanda Waltz and Nick and I believe. But I will say that
never mind.
One of my favorite stories is the fact that we had like an hour and a half long conversation about To the Wonder. And I was the only one who liked it. And I had to fight with them for them to even appreciate the aesthetic beauty of that movie. Harrowing, soul-rending experience for me. And then, when it came time for top tens to come out, both of them had To the Wonder higher on their lists than I did. I was furious. Each of them said that after the conversation that we had, they had revisited the movie and been, I guess, evangelized to its side. And I was furious. I was so angry that they had made me spend an hour and a half screaming at them, trying to get them to understand this movie. And then in the end, they came over to my side. But I think the problem was that they had never told me. They had never said, hey, guess what? I like To the Wonder now. So I'm sitting there listening to their top tens, and I'm like, what is this fucking bullshit? Like, when did this happen? I was deeply upset.
Is this a bad time to mention 999 is my number one?
I would love that, actually.
If Burn it down.
Is your number
Burn it
one,
down.
You fucking maniac.
Fuck that.
I think also, I'll just say, like, the saddest thing that ever happened was I was deeply under the impression, I think last year or the year before, I can't remember when it came out, that Nick Newman would have Nonstop starring Liam Neeson on his top 10. But it turned out it was his number 12. So I spent the entire podcast just getting more and more excited for how high up on his list it would be. And then it ended up not. So that was quite a letdown. Anyway, let us get started. I've got a little music to kick off the section. Here we go.
Boy.
That is, without a doubt, my favorite song from Beyoncé, Countdown. And I might have used this...
Badass.
Yeah, the song is great. I may have used it, a year or two ago, but I legitimately don't care. It's So, let us begin. We're going to do this alphabetically. Now, the question becomes... Bill... For the purpose of alphabetical evaluation, would you prefer to be Bill or William?
For alphabetical reasons, Bill, but my full name is William, so.
But you would prefer
make of that,
that
what
use,
you will.
We prefer that we cheat you as a B rather
yeah,
than
Yeah, I'll
a
go
w.
first.
Wait, what's your middle name, Bill?
Bill.
What?
What's your middle name?
What's your middle name?
Fitzgerald.
Okay.
Is that...
No, that's
this
cool.
This is giving way too much information.
So now we have to take your placement by your first name, divide it by the placement of your middle name, and then add the placement of your last name. Michael Snydell. What is your...
What?
Well, we're going... We're going M, and then I guess B... R and then B I.
So we're going the opposite of.
Yeah, it's a countdown.
What?
A countdown from the bottom to the top. So Michael Snydell.
Whatever. You got me all hyped up.
All right, cool.
All right, fuck it. Then Bill, okay, you're number 10.
Yeah?
Wait, am I going or is Bill going?
Yeah, Bill's going. You talked me into it, Mike.
He mumbled his way out of it.
Yeah,
that's
he did. His confusion right. touched me.
My number 10. Alright. My number 10 is Green Room. I think this is one of the most intense thrillers that I've seen all year. They are a rare breed that are this just openly all about one singular focus, and that is to make you sweat and make you just grip the edge of your chair. I think the performances by the late Anton Yelchin, Imogen Poots, so many performances in this film are just fantastic, but this is one of the most intense films that I've seen all year. Probably, you know, one of them, probably top 10 in like a decade of movie watching. This is an absolute highlight if you haven't seen it. I would suggest bringing a friend to hold on to, because holy shit, this film goes for it. So yeah, that's my number 10.
All right, my number 10 is Hell or High Water.
Yeah.
So Hell or High Water is a movie that we actually talked about on this podcast, so you can go back and check that out. This is directed by David McKenzie's, and it stars Jeff Bridges, Chris Pine, and Ben Foster. It is the story of two brothers who are robbing local banks in Texas in order to buy back their land from that self-same bank, which apparently had been screwing over their mother with weird reverse mortgage subprime nonsense. It is a great crime story, A, a wonderful character piece, B, and also one of the most well-made and, like, I can't think of the words I'm looking for. It's one of the few movies that has dealt with the financial crisis and its impact on, like, non-top-tier economic citizens.
Sure.
In the best possible way.
The middle and lower class.
Yeah, I was trying to avoid saying that because it sounds... I mean, I'm middle and lower class, but I wasn't alive in a state of that time where I would have had to deal with that. So this movie is one of the few movies that has taken that and not used it in a kind of Big Short sort of way where they just talk about it. This is a movie that shows you what it's about and then uses it to tell an entertaining story. At the time, I had said that this movie in 10 or 20 years is going to be one of those films that people watch to understand the anxiety of this time, and I do believe that to be true. So come for the performances and stay for the action and the economic message. So Michael Snydell, what is your number 10?
My number 10 is a Spanish, I think it's Spanish and Dutch. It's a Spanish and Dutch film called Embrace of the Serpent. I don't know. I don't think you guys have talked about it this year, but I'll just give a quick recap. It is a film about two explorers who are separated by decades in time, and they're searching for a fictional hallucinogenic plant. And it's kind of a adventure story. It's an absurdist comedy. It's a kind of commentary on colonialism, but it's like, it's one of the most, kind of singular things I've seen this year. And it's just, it's incredible that it's able to move from it's almost like a reversal of like a Werner Herzog style story. It's very much about what happened how villagers like view the explorers who come, and it's weird because it's a satire, but it's also very melancholy, and it's kind of unidentifiable, and also kind of very much a mess at times too. But it's one of my favorite films of the year. Again, it's called Embrace the Serpent.
All right. That finishes off our tens. Now it's time to go to the nines. Bill Graham.
All right. So my number nine is a film by Whit Stillman. It is Love and Friendship. This is a period comedy film that stars Kate Beckinsale and Chloe Sevigny. This film is hilarious in all the ways that I wasn't expecting to fall for an Austin film. I am a staunch non-Austin fan, and this film won me over.
How can you be a staunch non-fan of someone?
Yep. What?
Like, you have to like put a lot of effort into it?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. It makes me angry. A lot of her stuff makes me angry. But this film just, what this film does for me is that it puts the power all in the women's hands. And it makes it very clear that even back then, despite a lot of the trappings of, you know, women not having a lot of roles, a lot of options back then, they were still in a lot of ways very much, at least when they were old enough to make the decision and not forced into marriages, they were very much the ones that kind of had control over who they were going to marry and kind of the dealings with that. Of course, at a certain point, you know, without the ability to rely on a family's income, you were kind of put against the clock. But this film kind of explores that in a very hilarious way. It is delightful, a delightful film. I just was not expecting to fall for this film. And it's got a weird kind of setup and execution. But overall, if you can kind of get past a little bit of the language, I think it improves on a second and third watch. I've seen this film, I believe, 3 times now, and each watch it gets better and better, because by the second time you know exactly what's going on and why, and so you're able to kind of ease into it a lot better. So yeah, one of my favorite films of the year.
This also has one of the best supporting performances of the year in it.
Yes, absolutely.
And that is Tom Bennett as Sir James Martin, who is
delightful.
That whole delightful cast is
dullard. All right.
I like Stephen Fry a lot in there too.
Yeah. So get ready for some whiplash, because my 2016 top 9 film is The Neon Demon, which could not be further from Love and Friendship. Wait, Bill, are you upset about this choice?
I guess we're going to talk about it.
All right, so The Neon Demon.
Let's do this.
It's the newest film by Nicholas Winding Refn, and it stars Elle Fanning as a model named Jessie who goes to Los Angeles, who is so ethereally and preternaturally beautiful that she quickly rises through the ranks, leaving a trail of the disaffected in her wake. This is a moody, hypnotic, gorgeous, fucked up film. The film that will, in my mind, forever be linked to nearly sending my wife into an early labor.
Oh, so, yeah.
That was awesome. That now. What was that?
I said, I remember that now.
Oh, yeah. It would have been hilarious if that had actually been when our daughter was born, because I would love to be able to tell her the story of how this movie led to her early arrival in our world, but it was not to be. probably for the best. So yeah, The Neon Demon, a gorgeous, stunning, provocative film that I really quite enjoyed, obviously, because it's my number 9. And Bill apparently doesn't agree.
The film has deep issues, I think, but I definitely see that this film is a fever dream and a fucked up nightmare, a huge improvement over his last film, thankfully.
Only God Forgives.
So
yeah, yes. Only God
which
Forgives
was complete and utter trash.
That was my number 10 of that year, tied with Spring Breakers.
Okay,
what was that?
I actually watched Only God Forgives a couple days before I saw Neon Demon, and I didn't hate it, but I found it a little bit of an endurance test.
Oh,
but like Neon Demon, I guess the problem with Neon Demon for me though is that it is two different movies, and I like one movie way more than the other. And that's the runway, like the spiritual, runway exorcism style stuff. Like, I really like that stuff. And then towards the end, I just found the movie feeling like it was really disdainful of the audience. And it's just as it gets more and more violent and just more and more mean-spirited, like, it was really hard for me to stick with the film as a whole, even though there's imagery in there that I think is like among the best cinematography of the year.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And this is definitely a movie that hates you, so it's fine.
Yeah.
Let's move on.
It's frustrating.
Well, Michael Snydell, why don't you cleanse our palates? What is your number 9 choice for the year of 2016?
Going into another form of whiplash. My number 9 is Kelly Reichardt's latest film, Certain Women. So I'm kind of in the tank for Reichardt. I've liked almost every one of her films, but the way that I've talked to a lot of people about this one is it feels like a catharsis for her career, because to put it kindly, most of Reichardt's films have been about women or characters who are put in situations that seem almost cosmically unfair. And as much as they, fight against the world, it still seems like they're, still failing. And so Certain Women I found to be a really kind of emotional experience in a way that I didn't expect, because it's about it's an anthology story. And it is very much a Reichardt film in the way that it uses, the way that our backgrounds and environments, influence us and, imbue us with a sense of loneliness and things like that. But there's also just a sense that these characters are finally being recognized as people, for lack of a better word. So it is very much a Reichardt film, but it also feels a lot less oppressive than her other films and kind of comforting. And it has some of the best actors of this generation, Laura Dern, Michelle Williams, and Kristen Stewart, who I know is more controversial. I'm not sure how you guys feel about her. I'm a big fan of her.
Yeah.
I love the third act of this film. So
I have seen it twice, and I will agree that the third act is the most immediate one. But I think the whole thing works together, even when it doesn't want to always fit together in the most graceful ways. I guess that's the best way I'd put it without getting into spoilers. But
I'm ashamed that I have not seen
my number 9.
Film. All right. Well, Bill Graham, hit us up with your choice for the 8th favorite film of the year for you.
Or sure. You so this silence. Is going to be Kenneth Lonergan's. I'm talking. This can be Manchester, or this can be Jesus Christ. You fucked me up, Ryan. This is Kenneth Lonergan's Manchester by the Sea. This film hit me like a ton of bricks. This is a film that is super, super weighty, super heavy. It is. I was told that it was kind of had a lightheartedness to it, and it definitely does through have a kind of delightful through line because of Lucas Hedges and his 16-year-old antics. But for the most part, this is a deep dive into Casey Affleck as Lee Chandler's just deep-rooted depression about what's happened in his life and his dealing with having to suddenly take care of his brother's son, Lucas Hedges, played by Lucas Hedges. And he's not dealing with it too well. Not that Patrick Lucas Hedges in this film does much to help him along the way. They both kind of butt heads throughout the film, and that's where much of the comedy kind of comes from. And it's just between Casey Affleck and Michelle Williams, their few and brief interactions in this film are easily what kind of sell it as a overall work that really needs to be seen. The performances are just so fantastic. I love the way that the characters are written. This is a very blue collar film. It is, there isn't a lot of beauty to be seen here, except for kind of the, not even the surrounding. Like, honestly, like it's a very morose film. But I really fell for it, and it's just a very, very deep dive into depression and what that can kind of play out as.
All right.
Yep.
Not to tip my hand, but you'll probably be seeing that movie come up again. Now it's time for...
Although totally tipping your hand.
Here's another way to tip my hand.
Uh-oh. Yeah.
So my choice for my eighth favorite film of the year 2016, Everybody Wants Some. I don't know if that's how it's pronounced with those two exclamation points, but this is the newest film from director Richard Linklater, and it is just pure fun. That's pretty much it. But this movie is so rewatchable, so immediately charming, so full of good feelings for all of its characters. Even that asshole who keeps screaming about how he's a raw dog. That I don't know why this movie didn't do better. This movie is like a feel-good hit with so much warmth and humanity. It's some people like called it like a celebration of bro culture. I honestly think this is, like, the least bro-y movie possible, because these guys are allowed to be goofy, they're allowed to be themselves, and they're allowed to look at other cultures in their school without any kind of ironic
distance. Self is pretty bro-y, isn't it?
I don't think so. I think of, like, iron pumping, like, I'm better than everyone, but these guys are, like, so open to everything and so accepting of everyone else that I think you can't apply the bro label to them. This is, of course, about a freshman pitcher on a baseball team in a Texas college who spends his first weekend before classes start partying and practicing. And it's just fun. It's just like, I watched this, I bought the Blu-ray, popped it in because I was going to do some cleaning, and I was like, I've seen this movie and I can just listen to the dialogue. I didn't get anything done. I immediately had to sit down and just watch the whole damn movie. So, Everybody Wants Some. That is my choice for the eighth best film of 2016.
The easiest film to watch of the entire 2016.
Yeah. You like sink into it and it flows along with you, and it's just great. It's just a great film.
Yep.
Michael Snydell. Yep. Number eight.
My number eight is a film that I'm hoping more people get to see in the upcoming year. I know our benevolent Lord and Master is actually a pretty big fan of it, too. It's a Chinese film called Kylie Blues. And it is it played at New Director New Films in New York. So it's had a couple festival showings, but I don't think it's widely available anywhere yet. But it's a Chinese film about a man who owns a medical dispensary with an older woman, and she finds out that one of her former lovers is dying, and entreats this young man to go to the town where she grew up and get something related to this man. And so it's like, it's that very simple story, but what it's really about is it's kind of a meditation on time and just the kind of living past. And I don't really want to say more about it, but it has a very strange view towards time, but it also feels very mundane. So I know it's also been compared to a director like, holy shit, I'm not going to say his name, but the director who did Uncle Boon Me. No, because I just looked at the name and I was like, nope, not doing it. But I guess it also has some of my favorite cinematography of the year, especially from a debut. There's a 45-minute tracking shot that a lot of people have talked about. But there's the way that this film plays with like shadows and light. Like there's a scene that is a homage to Lumiere where a train literally seems to come through a brick wall. Like there's just all of these fantastic visual grace notes in this, and it just kind of casts a spell over you. And you know, there's some people who haven't been able to get into it, but you know, if you find yourself under its trance, like it's a really interesting experience.
Did you catch this in a theater?
I caught this through a screener. But I believe it is coming to streaming very soon.
Because I'll be honest with you, a lot of times when films like this pop up on lists, it's usually because the critic has seen it in an actual theater and they fell for it in kind of that environment. And it sucks because oftentimes what their next recommendation is go see it in a theater if you can. And it's like, yeah, sure. But it played in two screens in the entire U.S.
That's really difficult,
you know?
Yeah. All right. Well, no, let's go.
It's actually coming out. I just looked it up. I believe it's coming out through Grasshopper.
Film. Nick Newman should be able to hook us up.
I was about to say, what the hell's Nick Newman?
Blu-ray comes out on April 11th. Excellent. April 11th is when the Blu-ray comes out. So other people should be able to see it relatively soon. If that sounds like something that's you're into, I would check it out.
All right. Number seven picks. Lucky number seven, Bill Graham. What is your number seven pick for the best film of the year?
This is my favorite neo-Western heist crime film of the year. This is by David McKenzie with a script written by Taylor Sheridan, who has now become one of my kind of go-to screenwriters with last year's Sicario and this year's Hell or High Water. This is one of my favorite films of the entire year, based almost entirely on the ending that actually gives stakes to all of the shenanigans and all of the craziness that these two brothers, played by Chris Pine and Ben Foster, get up to, with Jeff Bridges as the Texas Ranger hot on their trail. Jeff Bridges is full on racist in this film, but with a deft and light touch that I think a lot of people are kind of missing. You can read him as a straight up racist, or you can read him as having a partner that he has a little bit of a rapport with and is basically just cracking jokes at the entire time while a very serious situation is playing out in front of them. I think he is not really that big of a racist. This is just his way of dealing with the situation and the stress that he's kind of under. But again, this film has probably the biggest stakes of any film I've seen this year. And they play it out, and the ending is just so utterly beautiful that I think this film has really been kind of knocked as this kind of Trump's America, kind of deep dive in a way, or no, actually shallow dive. A lot of people think this film is very shallow, and I couldn't disagree more. It is thrilling to watch. It is hilarious. Ben Foster just gives this super unhinged performance, and I loved it. Yeah.
That's what you want Ben Foster for, is a super unhinged performance. He excels at that, and I'm not
true
even
enough.
Being glib. Like, that's just his level. Then I definitely agree, because that was one of my top 10. All right, my choice, number 7, film of the year, Kubo and the Two Strings, directed by Travis Knight.
Fuck this movie.
Yeah, whatever. Go fuck yourself. Hey, Bill, do you ever figure out why it's called Kubo and the Two Strings? You ever figure that shit out?
I know.
You're lucky I didn't make fun of you on the silence review. I was going to start off by asking, Bill, did it bother you that this movie had a lot of sound in it? Anyway, Kubo... We have to give a second for Mike's maniacal laughter to subside.
I'm done.
Okay. You're clearly not done.
I'm going to mute myself. All right. Jesus.
Kubo and the Two Strings. Stop-motion animation from Laika, directed by Travis Knight. This movie is all about the power of stories and son's love for his mother and father and their love for him. And it is just a gorgeous, glorious, moving tale that you can come back to again and again to admire both its aesthetics and its themes and narrative. So that is why I chose Kubo and the Two Strings as my 2017 number 7 choice. Michael Snydell, unmute yourself, sober up, and tell us what your number 7 pick is. Still laughing.
My number 7 pick is a film we talked about on the podcast.
Oh, holy shit.
It is one that Brian has complete and utter apathy for. And that's Kristen Johnson's Camera Person. So, again, we've talked about it a lot, so I don't want to say too much about it. Hey, Brian, who's going right now?
You are. Good.
I've had a lot of time to think about it. I have not watched it again, but it's a film that was overwhelming at the time and overwhelming afterward, in the sense of I like that this film both feels like it has no narrative through line and a strong thematic through line. And it's that tension that makes me think about this film so much as an experience that I want to go back to as soon as possible. And, you know, maybe with time that will start to feel more like chaos, but either way, this first time when I watched this, there's images in here that have just stuck with me for now. You know, what, 6 months since? I don't even know when we recorded that podcast. But all I'm saying is, it's a good film. Maybe you'll like it, and maybe you'll be soulless like Brian. But check it out.
Yeah, it's definitely worth checking out. Just because it literally did nothing for me doesn't mean it won't for you. All right, Bill Graham. Number 6 on your list of the best films or favorite films of 2016.
This is going to be a Disney film, of all things.
Is it
this is No. Shout out to my boy David Lowry for giving me my favorite Disney film of the entire year, Pete's Dragon.
Yes.
I was not expecting. I was not expecting to fall head over heels for this film at all. I didn't know what to expect from this. I still bristle at the idea of the dragon itself, but everything else about this film is absolutely gorgeous. It is a beautiful, beautiful film. It does have some... Carl Urban kind of plays a very kind of above reality kind of character. He's very over the top, and yet despite that, I still just couldn't help but fall for Oakes Fegley as Pete, this young orphan boy who Bryce Dallas Howard and Una Lawrence find in the woods, and he's hanging out with this invisible dragon, or I guess he's not invisible. He's a camouflaging dragon, I guess is a better way to describe it. Yes, very much so. And he's just, Oakes Fegley is just so good in this film. Una Lawrence, who has to play off of him quite a bit, she is fantastic as well. And then one of the most stirring performances by Robert Redford in years, in like 5 minutes of screen time, he just kills it. This is one of just, it's such an easy film to watch, and it will get underneath your skin very quickly, and it's just utterly beautiful. There's not a lot more that I can say beyond the fact that this film, what it does so carefully and what it does so beautifully is that it gives you Pete, or it gives you the dragon, right? And it, with all of its kind of history, mythical and otherwise, and it never plays it for this big action blockbuster kind of scenario until the very end. And it's only then when we finally get kind of this, the big kind of set piece. Everything before that is all of these subtle situations, even down to the way the dragon moves, the way that he flies. He's a bumbling fool at times. There's just so much joy throughout this film that I just couldn't help but fall for it.
Agreed. This was in my top 10 for the longest time. Unfortunately, stuff started forcing it out, and it is now in my top 20. This is the first movie I ever took.
Did you return to it, Bill?
I unfortunately have not seen it yet, or seen it again yet.
Say what?
It's on my list.
Yet.
Yeah.
That trailer looked great.
I haven't seen it this year. Let me say that.
Sure.
All right. So... it took me a second to wrap my head around what you just said. I forgot that it's 2017. My number six is The Vessel. This is a movie that came out in very limited release. I wrote the review for the film stage, and I shouted it out on this show. It is by Julio Quintana, and it takes place at a village where not too long ago a tidal wave slammed into the town and destroyed the school where all of the children were, and now all of the people have basically decided to give up on faith and life and everything, and a young man who undergoes what some have considered a miracle starts to stir the town again and guide them back towards something a little like healing. This is a beautiful film. It was produced by Terrence Malick, and that really shows in the cinematography. It also has a deeply affecting performance by Martin Sheen as the priest in this town. And in general, it's just one of those things that you really won't, like, you don't see a lot of movies like this. And I think that if you're the type of person who loves Terrence Malick aesthetically, but wishes that he would kind of, like, stick to a narrative, this is the movie for you. So that is The Vessel. It is, I don't know. I would love to say that it's streaming or on Blu-ray, but I honestly don't know, and I apologize. Michael Snydell, your choice for the sixth best film of 2016.
My choice for, I don't know if it's the sixth best, it's my favorite. Jeez.
Sixth favorite film of 2016.
This is an objective. as much as you guys would like to believe.
We're
anyways,
on number six.
My sixth
Why
film.
Has this only become a problem now?
All right, my sixth film is Marinade's Tony Erdmann. And so this is a nearly 3-hour German comedy. And so there's other movies that I laughed at more this year. But Tony Erdmann was – there was no other movie this year that made me think more about like – the existential tear in comedy. And so what's interesting to me about this movie is that, you know, at times it does feel like, you know, like an extended Jackass skit. Like there are parts of this that feel like, is it Dirty Grandpa, the Johnny Knoxville Jackass one? Or is it Bad Grandpa, the Robert De Niro one? Dirty Grandpa,
Bad Grandpa. Yeah. Bad Grandpa is the Jackass one.
Okay, so it has some similarities to things like that, or things at times like Adam Sandler things in some of the comedy. But what's so interesting to me about this movie is that it's not a series of set pieces. It's all the emotional moments are what happens after all of the cringing has ended. And so it's this father-daughter story, and it just lingers after the jokes have been told and after that dead air is there. And so it becomes almost an exploration of how we view our family and at what point our annoyance and, you know, sometimes deep embarrassment, like when that can turn into like begrudging admiration. So it's a really interesting film. It has one of my absolute favorite performances with Sandra Hüller, and it is pretty funny. So I have to think it's coming out relatively soon. I think it's going to be one of the foreign language front runners at the Oscars.
People keep talking about this, and this is something that I guess I can address now. This year has been very hard for me to tell when things are coming out. And like I just feel like I've been hearing about so many of these films for so long, and I just think that I missed them, and then I find out that they haven't happened yet, like Tony Erdmann and 20th Century Women and all these other things where I'm like getting notes now for press screenings, and I'm like, oh, that didn't happen months ago? Shit. All right, well, that's great. I guess
Tony Erdmann in particular was at Cannes. And you know, like 20th Century Women that you explained, like it's just the festival system has really fucked with anybody who's remotely in the film writing business. Like knowing people who go to festivals, like it just fucks with your entire sense of when things are coming out. And then that doesn't even take into account where you are in the country.
This is very true. It should also be noted that there are some films that we didn't see that may go on our lists as we see them. And we will take care of those after we're done with our top 10. So let's move into the final stretch. Number 5, Bill Graham.
Woo! All right. This is definitely one of my favorite films of the year. This was one of my most anticipated films of the year. I fell for the short novel that it was based on, written by Patrick Ness, who also ended up being the screenplay writer for this film as well. He adapted his own short novel into J.A. Bayona's A Monster Calls. This film, it manages to keep the heartrending third act in the film that just absolutely destroys people. This was one of my favorite books. This turned into one of my favorite movies, and it is absolutely stunning in its kind of exploration of grief and anger and loss and all of these kind of very subtle and very difficult to talk about subject matters. And it does it in a children's story. This is very squarely aimed at younger audiences, and yet it also has the ability to talk to older audiences as well. Whether you're a teenager, whether you're an adult, whatever it may be, the film stars Louis McDougal, who plays a young boy. He's a teenager that his mother, Felicity Jones, is struggling with kind of this illness. And the entire time her illness has kind of taken a tailspin, and he's visited by a tree monster voiced by Liam Neeson. And each night he's given a different story that is told in these watercolor type visions. I'm trying to remember the animated film that Princess Kaguya that was a Studio Ghibli film that came out I think it was either late last year or early two years ago, and that film had just this beautiful watercolor style to it, and these individual stories that the monster tells also has that beauty. They are the most visually striking moments throughout the film. The film is very gray, very earth toned, and these visual stories are the only moments of kind of pop and flash in the film. And it's just telling this, these intricate stories that have all of these interesting twists and turns that turn a lot of the what Disney or Disneyfied kind of fairy tales, it turns them kind of on the head, and it goes back to kind of their origins in a way. A lot of these Disney or Disney films, whether it's like the Snow Queen or things like that, Tangled, the basis of a lot of those films is really kind of dark and disturbing. If you've read the actual children's tales and things like that, and this, the stories each kind of have that feeling to them, where they're very, very honest. And yeah, this film just, it blew me away. It's beautiful to watch. The creature is very, very well made and integrated into the film. And yeah, that's my number five.
All right. My number five is Silence. We just published our podcast on this, so let me be as brief as possible. Aesthetically beautiful, narratively challenging. Great for anyone who's interested in interrogating religion and faith. Michael Snydell, what is your number five? I mean, come on. There's literally an hour and 40 minutes of us talking about this film that just came out. So go to that. Silence,
yeah,
number
but
five.
Not 2 hours and 41 minutes. Like, you need to make up for that time.
No. All right, you make a point. All right, so now here is me talking for an hour and 1 minute solo about Silence. No. Michael Snydell, what is your number five favorite film of the year?
My number five pick was actually also one of my most anticipated for 2016. And that is Mike Mills' third film, 20th Century Women.
God damn.
It's a follow-up to his film Beginners. And, you know, just as Beginners was about, you know, pretty directly, honestly, was about Mike Mills' experience with his father. 20th Century Women is about the experience, or excuse me, his experiences with the women in his life. And, you know, there are the different characters. You have Greta Gerwig, you have Elle Fanning, and you have Annette Bening. They're all, you know, they're avatars for, you know, our mothers, the cool aunts, the first crushes. Like, they're all those represent those pivotal moments. But what I like so much about this film, besides for it's just really, really finely tuned coming of age story is that these women aren't, they're not props for this character's growth. If anything, the main boy is not really even the main character. And so what this movie manages to do is it manages to at first kind of create this mythos of, you know, like cool and of, you know, mystery around these women, like especially his mother. And then it completely dispels that and says that, no, these are real people and you're getting a glimpse at them, but you don't know them and don't pretend you do. And that's just it's a deeply refreshing way to tell a story. And it feels very genuine and honest. And it's just it's a joy. And Annette Bening, you know, she's going to get lost in this awards race, but she's literally this is one of the best performances I've ever seen from her.
Yeah, this is one of my most anticipated for 2016, and I am super upset that I haven't had a chance to see it yet. This probably would have ended up on my list given how much I loved Beginners.
I haven't had a chance to catch this one either. It's unfortunately I didn't get a screener of it or anything like that. So I think it's in limited release right now. So it should hopefully kind of slowly expand.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Bill Graham, number four.
This is a film that neither of y'all liked all that much, but I still loved dearly. It is Barry Jenkins' Moonlight. This film would have ended up higher on my list had I seen it probably, I won't say sooner, but the top four are very much in limbo. All right. But just the same, I have to give a number. And so this fell on number four. This is a triptych film. It follows a young boy through three different kind of ages, and each played by a different actor. And it is one of the most affecting love stories that I've seen in quite a while. It is told with a certain distance that I think a lot of people that didn't quite fall for Carol last year will kind of recognize again this year. But it also has one of the biggest standout performances from one of the actors that made the big splash the entire year, Mahershala Ali as Juan, this drug dealer that comes across a young little who turns into Chiron, who turns into Black, played by Alex Hibbert. Plays little, and the first act of this film really kind of sets the tone, and with Mahershala Ali's interaction with this young boy, it's about a young black boy that grows up in Miami and kind of the projects of Miami, and is dealing with all of these questions of masculinity and what his place in this world kind of is, and all of these just very, very heavy, heavy things that are going around while he's struggling to live with his single mom who quickly turns into a drug addict. And it paints a picture that just is beautiful in the way that we all kind of struggle to find our own place in the world. And that's very much Little's journey throughout. It's also one of my, I think, one of the most beautiful films as far as cinematography and also the integration of music. It was mentioned in some of our year-end lists as well. And yeah, I think this film is going to end up being a very a very heralded film that probably won't win a lot of awards this year.
I'm not allowed to talk about Moonlight anymore, so moving on. My number four pick is Arrival. This is the film by...
Woo.
Yes, woo indeed. that's almost a line from the trailer for A Monster Calls. Anyway, Denis Villeneuve, and this is starring Amy Adams and Jeremy Renner and Forrest Whitaker and Michael Stuhlbarg. And this is all about aliens who come to the world, and Louisa Banks, who is played by Amy Adams, is a doctor of language who has to try to figure out how we communicate with these people. And the movie is all about communication, the way that we view our lives, the way that we tell the stories of our lives. In fact, it is based off of a short story called The Story of Your Life, and it is fantastic. Aesthetically beautiful, very deeply intellectually satisfying and emotionally satisfying, and one of a few movies this year that kind of like sent me to the edge of tears in the theater. That is Arrival, again, directed by Denis Villeneuve. Expect to see it hopefully during awards season. Michael Snydell, your choice for number four.
My number four is this was the first year that I checked out films by South Korean auteur Hong Sang-soo. And you know, for a long time I was kind of put off by what was being described, or what at least okay, so the way he's described is that he has built essentially a career off of variations on the same exact thematic, structural, and formal choices, in the sense that nearly every one of his movies is about film critics, drinking, and pathetic men in love triangles. And
all right.
So I saw three movies, including... three movies of his this year, including Right Now, Wrong Then. And he, this sounds very academic, but his movies are deeply instructive in how I watch movies. Like the experience of watching Right Now, Wrong Then is getting an out-of-body experience of understanding why we react to like romantic comedy conventions, and whether conversations feel genuine, and when a camera feels like it is, you know, just a fly on the wall, and when it feels like it is another person in the room. And so it's his Right Now, Wrong Then is simply about the two ways that, a single night can go between two strangers. And so what it does is it's, I almost don't want to say this, but it's,
I mean, you
separated.
Don't have to. You can just say it's a good movie.
I feel like I have to mention this briefly. So each half has slight changes, and different things happen. And I guess the thing about Hong Sang-soo is that there are almost no directors I can think of that more capture like the ebb and flow of a conversation and the way that a tone or a specific word choice can completely change the directions of like a future. And so it's a really entertaining, funny movie, but it's also the movie that made me think the most about watching movies. So I highly recommend that one. I know it's places, but I don't know where. It's called Right Now, Wrong Then, though.
All right. Bill Graham, your number three choice.
The longest film of the entire year, perhaps. This is Ezra Edelman's twisting, lurid OJ Made in America, that is about as intricate of an exploration of a topic that I've ever seen in my entire life. This film deals with race and celebrity in ways that give me perspective outside of just its focus, O.J. Simpson, but more on the United States as a whole and how we deal with some of these situations that still are very much not settled. It deals with police brutality. It deals with the L.A. riots. It deals with all of these situations. The fact that O.J. Simpson, for better or for worse, was essentially not a black man. And yet when it came down to the trial, he turned into a black man. And it deals with all of the pitfalls of kind of our legal system and the way that they can be twisted and really put against African Americans, but also the trial system itself. Whether a trial is run well can ultimately end up being the reason that someone is acquitted or found guilty. And it's disturbing in that way. It's also disturbing in the implications of OJ as a later celebrity and his embrace of kind of the darkness. This is it's over 7 hours long, which I do not recommend lightly. As much of y'all know, I have a huge issue with anything that runs over 2 hours. If it is not in fact worthy of that runtime, and this is exceptionally worthy of your time and energy to seek out. I still kind of bristle at the idea that this is a documentary. I think this is more miniseries than anything, but that is because of the format that it was kind of, at least initially put on my radar as a 30 for 30 series by ESPN Films. But it did have a small run in two theaters, New York and LA.
It also premiere at Sundance.
No, it did. No, it premiered at Sundance.
It was Sundance? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's crazy. But I'm just so glad that this film is out there, that it's made, and it is absolutely worthy of your time and energy to seek out.
All right. My number three film for the year is The Witch. And Woo! This is a film by David Eggers. I wrote the directorial debut and breakthrough performance write-ups for this movie. We also had a full podcast about it, so I don't feel the need to say much. Needless to say, if you're looking... Well, everyone else is talking for 17 minutes at a time. I'm trying to keep us moving. And if we've had a full podcast about it, for God's sakes, don't listen to me talk about it for 30 seconds now. Go listen to that podcast. Or better yet, just go watch the movie. But yeah, as far as movies that take rigid historical accuracy in terms of production design and dialogue, and then apply the concept of what if all them Puritans were right about witches in the woods, you can't do much better than The Witch. This is a gorgeous movie. The lighting, the production design, the bleak, bleak atmosphere is all done perfectly. And it's a movie that finally asks the question that I think all of us have been longing to be asked. What's that wish to live deliciously? So, watch The Witch and find out. Michael Snydell.
I'm a big fan of butter.
Oh, yeah. You love the taste of butter. Michael Snydell, what is your third favorite film of the year?
My third favorite film of the year, Bill already mentioned it. It's Love and Friendship. Woo. By Whit Stillman.
Woo.
And yeah, I'm not going to go too far over it. Performances are excellent. But I do have to take issue with the Austin hates. I'm a big Jane Austen fan. And what I really like about this movie is it's a reminder of how subtly mean Austen's material can be and how funny so many of her lines are. And, a lot of adaptations, I think, are so worried about taking away or you know, about feeling irreverent towards the original source material that they forget that it is, you know, there's a deliciousness to the material. And you know, I guess the one other thing I would say about this is what I love so much about the structure of this is by the end, it feels less like a comedy or romance, but more like a heist movie. Like by the time you see how advanced and expansive Kate Beckinsale's scheming is, it's like, oh wow, you were planning this for a long, long time. And so it's yeah, it's just it's a joy, and I think it's honestly one of Stillman's best films.
I would definitely agree with that. And I will say, while I am not a fan of Austin, I am not a staunch non-fan of Austin. So,
which is still not possible, but whatever.
All right, let's move on to our number two, the runners up, the penultimate films of the year, Bill Graham.
Ooh, this is going to be a film that we have yet to talk about that I've been pushing to talk about for a while now. This is Pablo Larraín's Jackie, which Michael seems to be kind of mum on, but I fell head over heels for. I did watch this in screener format, and it still just absolutely destroyed me. This is one of the most unique situations kind of in U.S. history, as far as the timing, as far as the press, the hype around John F. Kennedy. The film basically takes place in the immediate aftermath of JFK's 1963 assassination, and it follows Natalie Portman as Jackie Kennedy and her dealing with the situation immediately following it, as she kind of recounts the story to Billy Crudup, who is a newspaper journalist at the time, or actually I think he was writing for Time magazine, if I remember correctly. But the way that this film kind of interweaves historical kind of fact and goes back and forth to tell this very careful, slowly built upon kind of Jenga block-esque narrative is both beautiful and harrowing at the same time. If you aren't quite aware of the situation, once JFK was assassinated, basically all of the building blocks to put Lyndon B. Johnson into office were immediately taken, you know, being put together. And to have to deal with that as a, you know, a recent widow, and also have to plan a funeral and do all of these things in the immediate eye of all of the celebrity that surrounded the JFK kind of family and presidency is just absolutely harrowing. John Hurt stars as a priest that is consulting with Jackie Kennedy. That is just beautiful. And it's also got a score by Micah Levi, who did what was it? It was 2 years
ago. Under the Skin.
Yeah, Under the Skin. This is, again, a return to form for him with this kind of propulsive, percussion-heavy, eerie score that is definitely worth seeking out on its own, but especially in the film. And that's all I'll say about that.
All right. My number two film, I guess I should also say I haven't seen Jackie, so it's possible that I will love it and it will take a place on my top 10. But I just haven't had the opportunity to. So hopefully we'll be able to give a talk about that later on. But my number two film is the film that sent me into an emotional and psychological tailspin for well over a week, and that is Manchester by the Sea. Again, I have written a rather long article about this film, and I have been a part of a podcast about this film. It is deeply affecting, a movie that deploys memory as a weapon, and a movie that truly understands the psychological toll of grief and survivor's guilt, and being responsible for something for which you can never feel yourself being forgiven. So if you're looking for a laugh out loud riot, good time at the movies, Manchester by the Sea is just the film for you. Casey Affleck gives a masterful performance. Michelle Williams is great in a supporting role. And Lucas Hedges is a goddamn wonder in this film as a young boy dealing with the death of his father and having to find a way to live beside his just viciously depressed uncle. So that is Manchester by the Sea. I believe it is still, it's definitely still out in theaters. And you should all check it out. Michael Snydell.
It's a good double feature with Everyone Wants Some.
Yeah.
I would recommend Everybody Wants Some immediately after Manchester by the Sea.
Do not
do it the opposite direction.
Yeah, you gotta take the downer and then give yourself a bump. I was gonna say Manchester by the Sea is a great double feature with The Shallows, because when you hear that young kid say, "It's not a shock," and then you can put on The Shallows and be like, "Oh, it's a shark, motherfucker." Shallows also narrowly outside of my top 10. Michael Snydell, your second favorite film of the year.
My second favorite film, I'm going to parrot Bill again with OJ Made in America, which is, again, as Bill said, it's a nearly 8-hour documentary. He got into all the stuff that's great about it. The one thing I want to say about it, which is why it's so high on my list and why I think it's so interesting structurally, is that it starts incredibly from an incredibly intimate space. And it starts in this in an area of California that is not coming to my mind. But so it starts in this very small area where OJ grew up. And within the first 2 to 3 hours, it somehow expanded into a national examination of all of these huge issues. But it never loses the forest for the trees. Yeah, the forest for the trees, in the sense of like it's constantly contextualizing every step of the way. And I, honestly, at times it does seem like there's some things that are spent less time on. To avoid spoilers, that feels weird to say about this, but to avoid spoilers, like it's really, really far into this before we get to, you know, what could be considered the main attraction.
Sure. Yeah.
It's as Bill said, yeah, it's fantastic, and it's not really a tough watch. I watched it in two sittings, one 5-hour sitting and one 2-hour sitting.
Dear God, 5 hours?
Yeah.
You say that's not a tough watch, but
I think I watched...
for some people, finding 5 full hours to just sit down would be rather tough.
I watched it from like 9 p.m. to 2 a.m. on the first sitting. So that was something.
All
yeah,
right.
It's great. Go check it out. It's a lot of different places. It might be the easiest thing to find.
Where is it?
Yeah.
Where is it?
ESPN.com, on demand. If you have any access to ESPN in any way, you can watch it.
I don't know that I do, but I'll check it out.
I think it's also obviously streaming on all the major platforms as well.
Yeah, but you have to pay for it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Anyway, this is it. This is what everyone came for. Our number one film of the year. Let's start off with Bill Graham.
I hope this is not a clean sweep. This might be, because I haven't heard this film mentioned yet on this list. This is a film that, again, breaks my two-hour mark. This is The Handmaiden. I absolutely loved this film. I hesitate to even describe it. In loose terms, it is
a very long podcast about this one.
Yes, very, very long. I hesitate to describe it too much in detail because I think there's so many nuances and so many intricate plot details that have to be kind of to set the kind of groundwork for that this film is hard to explain what it actually is. It plays out in three act structure, and it is a kind of an erotic thriller. It twists and it turns, and if you've ever seen a Park Chan-wook film, he's known for kind of his twists and turns in the films to double back on themselves, to reveal themselves more openly. This film is very explicit at times, and that's just kind of a forewarning for a lot of people that may want to sit down and watch this with their parents or some other weird, you know, situation like that. Probably not the greatest idea, but you know, some parents are progressive and whatever. But this is definitely one of the most interesting films that I've seen the entire year. It just completely and utterly goes for this stylistic tone and this kind of psychosexual thriller that absolutely works from beginning to end for me. Again, one of my favorite performances from an entire cast. And yeah, this is South Korea does it big, and Park Chan-wook, woo woo.
Woo woo.
All right. Sorry to disappoint you, Bill. No, this is not going to be a clean sweep for the
Damn
Handmaiden.
It.
That is my number 21 movie of the year.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's not saying bad things about that. It's just like...
No.
Having a baby really focuses you on only seeing the movies that you think are going to be really good. So, like, most of my list only starts to get real shitty about, like, 7 from the end. So... Anyway, my number one film, this will come as a shock to literally no one who knows me well. It is Knight of Cups by Terrence Malick.
Wow. And,
but why? Okay. I mean, it's a Terrence Malick film. It's going to be in my top 10.
I was thinking Triple Nine, but...
That would be...
I was thinking La La Land.
Yeah, definitely La La Land. Triple Nine role. For people who are interested came in at number 12, just behind The Nice Guys.
Jesus fuck.
Knight of Cups is I have said it before and I'll say it again. I'm loving this new kick that Terrence Malick is on. I'm loving his modern aesthetic. I'm loving his embrace of digital photography. I'm loving his more anarchic sensibilities, and I'm loving that he's still keeping up the mellifluous voiceovers. It's the perfect melding of his older style with his newer interests, and I dig it. And this movie is fascinating in the ways in which it explores a man whose choices in life have left him romantically bereft and just... with a soul ache that cannot be healed, basically, and watching him struggle with his family and his past relationships and his current relationships and just kind of searching for something is glorious to me. I've seen this movie 3 or 4 times this year, and it just opens up and gets better with every rewatch. So, Knight of Cups by Terrence Malick, starring Christian Bale. It is amazing, and it is another one where we had a rather long discussion about it on this podcast. So if you are interested in hearing more or have seen it and want to listen to what we thought, check that out. Michael Snydell, the time has come. Close us out with your number one film of the year.
My number one film of the year is Paul Verhoeven's L. And so Paul Verhoeven is another one who, even when I don't like his movies, I kind of love them. like I know I've talked about Showgirls on this show before. I mean, I I also really like Starship Troopers. I really like Total Recall. I love RoboCop. Like, and I have to be honest, like, I'm mostly familiar with his American work. So this is something that's a little bit out of what I expected, but not really, because this is another movie that's all about his obsession with high, low art and, you know, being the pervert and also the one who's being perverted. And it's, I mean, it has my favorite performance of the year and what I would say is the best performance of the year with Isabelle Huppert. And the reason why I think it's such an incredible performance is because she threads the line so precisely between passivity and strength and combining those two. So she is, even as her character is just put through the ringer in every possible emotional, physical, in every physical fashion, she still just emerges from this with a power and a conviction. And it's a film that has pissed a lot of people off. And it doesn't always back up its provocations. And it's... I guess the thing about it is that its messiness is crucial to why it works for me, mm-hmm. because it feels like a piece of trickery in the sense of at times it feels like this really austere character study, you know, with this very European story of, you know, of legacy and class and how rich people deal with each other, but then it is also deeply vulgar and you know has, you know, this weird armchair psychology and, you know, has these moments where Verhoeven is just like, oh hey, look what you're looking at, don't you feel gross now? But the thing that keeps it then from being a problem to me, in spite of all of those warring, you know, provocations, is that Huppert is ultimately in control. No matter what the movie is doing to her, it never feels like she's being a victim. And that is why it's the movie I've thought about more than any other movie this year, and why it's my favorite movie of 2016.
Yeah, yes. I really enjoyed it, and the person behind me in the theater at the press screening definitely did not enjoy it by his many interruptions of what the fuck, and at the end that's it.
This is another film.
It was maybe the best.
Go ahead, Mike.
No, it maybe has the best ending of any movie this year, yeah, with like the most insane musical cue ever.
Well, it's Verhoeven,
this is,
so
like
this is a movie that I didn't get a chance to see, and hopefully we're still going to try to talk about it as it goes on because it has been getting a lot of love.
I would love,
and it was a shock that it wasn't on the short list for the best foreign language Oscar. So maybe we'll write that wrong.
So that film.
And
I think.
Go ahead, Bill.
Bill, go ahead.
Jesus.
This film is easily, I think Michael kind of danced around it, but this is one of the most powerful feminist films of the entire year. This film puts all the power in Isabelle Huppert's character's hands. She is one of the strongest female protagonists in any film this year. Probably, you know, I won't get into hyperbolicness, but yeah. But this film, it is not surprising to me that the Academies didn't go for it.
Sure.
but the other film, my number one, actually didn't make the best foreign language film list either because it was not submitted by South Korea.
Oh,
damn it.
So that's kind of their own fault.
Oh, was it the Kim Jae-woon one? The one yep. from the I Saw the Devil directed? Okay.
Yep. So, yep.
Yeah. That's
there you
shame.
Go. Interesting.
I okay. want to, now that we're done, I want to speak directly to one of our listeners who talked to us on Twitter. Pitt, I apologize that none of us had Moonlight at number one. If you'd listened to the podcast throughout the year, as I know you have, this should not come as a shock to you, but I am sure that it stings.
That
all
we're
the same.
All racist.
Not all of us, just Michael. Yeah, so that's now. We're well over an hour and a half now. Oh, no, we're not well over it. We're literally 7 seconds over it. I'm going to say that, to close us out, just so that other people can hear the stuff that came at the back of our lists, we should do our 20 to 11 choices. But if you have them up, you have to say them as quickly as possible. Is everyone okay with that?
Yeah, fine. Give me one second.
All right. I will give you a second by going first. Number 20, Hacksaw Ridge. Number 19, Sing Street. Number 18, Pete's Dragon. Number 17, The Lobster. Number 16, Nocturnal Animals. Number 15, The Shallows. Number 14, Green Room. Number 13, Midnight Special. Number 12, Triple Nine. And number 11, The Nice Guys. All right, who wants to go next?
Yeah, I didn't have a top 20, so here we go. Top 15, the back half is Everybody Wants Some, L, 10 Cloverfield Lane, Arrival, and Sing Street.
Woo, Sing Street. Michael Snydell, are you ready?
Okay, 20, A Bigger Splash, 19, The Witch, 18, The Handmaiden, 17, Krisha, 16, Silence, 15, One More Time with Feeling, 14, I Am Not Your Negro, 13, Only Yesterday, 12, Neruda, and 11, Lemonade.
All right. So that is it. That is 2016 in a nutshell. I'm going to close this out by saying that movies that I haven't seen that probably would have made my list if I had include Fences, 20th Century Women, Elle, maybe Tony Erdmann, and then I'm sure there's another one that I can't remember at the moment either. But it got really packed towards the end of the year there. And it's unfortunate for me because I wasn't able to see them, but for people who were able to get out and see them, you know, fucking good for you, assholes. So that brings us to a close. Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure. 2017 promises to be packed with films, both great and small, worthy and terrible, and we will be there to talk about roughly 50 of them on this show. Let's close
Wait,
out.
So Triple X is obviously next week,
oh my
right?
God, yeah. I mean, if we don't talk about Triple X, the return of Xander Cage.
I kind of want to fucking see that. I don't know about
guys,
that.
Monster Cars.
Monster Cars. Oh, God.
That was this week.
Was it? Yeah. I know Underworld Blood Wars was.
Yep, yep.
Anyway, yeah. It's
I've seen all of those for some reason.
Life goes on much as it always has, and shitty movies get released, and we will talk about those as well as the good ones. Talking about good movies, Mubi.com, Mubi.com, you can go there and you will find movies that have been selected by curators to help you find the best of foreign and independent cinema. Go to Mubi.com/filmstage for your free 30-day trial. As we said, there's a lot of great stuff on there right now. My personal recommendation is that you go watch Fantastic Planet, a bizarre animated film that is just like, do me a favor, drop some acid and watch this movie, and your life will never be the same.
That's not a recommendation.
Yeah, it is. Drop some acid, watch this movie. Anyway, mubi.com/filmstage for your free 30-day trial, and enjoy it. Mubi, new year, no tagline. That's all. Guys, let's tell the fine people at home where we can be found between now and the next time we speak to them. Bill Graham, let's start with you.
You can find me questioning my entire identity because two of my top three films were well over 2 hours long on
You're really
Twitter
not on brand.
@CableBFG. Cable BFG, and then you can also find me writing about movies on The Film Stage and freshfiction.tv.
All right, Michael Snydell.
You can find me on Twitter at Snydell, where I will be talking about movies. I did not have something ready. Okay, anyway, if you wanted to read my top 10 list...
You don't have to have something.
No, but I need to. That's the thing. All right. If you want to hear what I just rehashed from for the last hour and 41 minutes, I also wrote up about 2,000 word write-up for The Film Stage of my top 10 films. Yeah, there's words there. Maybe you agree. Maybe you disagree.
Oh, my God.
Thank you for this song, by the way, Brian.
You're welcome. I can be found deflecting criticisms of my lack of love for Moonlight on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan. You can find my personal writing on my site, dearfilm.net. And of course, it's the end of the year. The Film Stage published a lot of lists celebrating many aspects of cinema this year, and we all wrote for that. You can find that at thefilmstage.com. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for spending 2016 with us. What is it, Bill?
Hashtag step on that thing.
Hashtag don't step on that thing. We're apparently making this a goddamn thing. Thank you so much for spending 2016 with us, and we look forward to giving you more fine, fun conversation well into the new year. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much. Join us next time. Sure, we be learning still.